This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Genius Foods. Become smarter, happier, and more productive while protecting your brain for life. By Max Lugavere with Paul Graywall, MD. Read by me, Max Lugavere. This digital audiobook comes with a PDF enhancement containing recipes and resources contained in the print edition of this book. Please download the PDF for free from your audiobook provider. Introduction. Before you play two notes, learn how to play one note, and don't play one note unless you've got a reason to play it. Mark Hollis. If you'd have told me a few years ago that I'd one day write a book about optimizing the brain, I would have been sure you had mistaken me for someone else. After I switched my college major from pre-med to film and psychology, the idea of a career in health seemed unlikely. This was compounded by the fact that soon after I graduated, I became entrenched in what I considered a dream job, a journalist and presenter on TV and the web. My focus was stories that I felt were underreported and could make a positive impact on the world. I was living in Los Angeles, a city I'd idolized as an MTV-watching teen growing up in New York, and had just ended a 5-year stint hosting and producing content for a socially conscious TV network called Current. Life was great, and it was all about to change. As much as I enjoyed the Hollywood life, I'd often find myself making trips back east to see my mom and two younger brothers. In 2010, on one of those trips home, my brothers and I noticed a subtle change in the way my mother, Kathy, walked. She was 58 at the time and had always had a spirited way about her, but suddenly it was as though she were wearing a spacesuit underwater. Each stride and gesture looked like a purposeful, conscious decision. Though I know better now, back then, I couldn't even make the connection between the way she moved and her brain's health. She also began offhandedly complaining of mental fogginess. This, too, was lost on me. No one in my family had ever had memory problems. In fact, my maternal grandmother lived to 96, and her memory was sharp until the end. But in my mom's case, it seemed as if her overall processing speed had slowed, like a web browser with too many open tabs. We started to notice that when we would ask her to pass the salt at dinner, it would take her a few extra beats to register. While I chalked up what I was seeing to normal aging, deep down I had a chilling suspicion that something wasn't right. It wasn't until the summer of 2011, during a family trip to Miami, that those suspicions were confirmed. My mom and dad had been divorced since I was 18, and this was one of the few times since then that my brothers and I were together with my parents under the same roof, seeking respite from the summer heat in my dad's apartment. One morning, my mother was standing at the breakfast bar. With the whole family present, she hesitated and then announced that she had been having memory problems and had recently sought the help of a neurologist. In an incredulous but playful tone, my father asked her, "Is that so? Well then, what year is it?" She stared at us blankly for a moment, and then another. My brothers and I chuckled and chimed in, breaking the uneasy silence. "Come on, how could you not know the year?" She responded, "I don't know," and began to cry. The memory is seared into my brain. My mom was at her most vulnerable, courageously trying to communicate her internal pain, defective but self-aware, frustrated and scared, and we were completely ignorant. It was the moment I learned one of life's hardest lessons, that nothing else means a thing when a loved one gets sick. The flurry of medical visits, expert consultations, and tentative diagnoses that followed culminated at the tail end of a trip to the Cleveland Clinic. My mom and I had just walked out of a renowned neurologist's office, and I was trying to interpret the labels on the pill bottles clutched in my hand. They looked like hieroglyphics. Staring at the labels, I silently mouthed out the drug names to myself in the parking lot of the hospital. Aricept. Sinemet. What were they for? Pill bottles in one hand, unlimited data plan in the other, I turned to the digital age equivalent of a safety blanket, Google. In 0.42 seconds, the search engine returned results that would ultimately change my life. Information on Aricept for Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease? No one had said anything about Alzheimer's disease. I became anxious. Why hadn't the neurologist mentioned that? For a moment, the world around me ceased to exist but for the voice in my head. Does my mom have Alzheimer's disease? Isn't that something only old people get? How could she have it, and at this age? Grandma's 94 and she's fine. Why is mom acting so calm? Does she understand what this means? Do I? How long does she have before whatever comes next? What does come next? The neurologist had mentioned Parkinson's plus. Plus what? Plus, it sounded like a bonus. Economy plus means more legroom, usually a good thing. Pert plus was shampoo plus conditioner, also a good thing. No. My mom was prescribed medicines for Parkinson's disease plus Alzheimer's disease. Her bonus feature was the symptoms of a bonus disease. As I read about the pills I was still holding, repeating phrases stuck out to me. No disease-modifying ability. Limited efficacy. Like a band-aid. Even the doctor had seemed resigned. I later learned a cold joke circulated among med school students about neurology. Neurologists don't treat disease, they admire it. That night, I was sitting alone in our Holiday Inn suite a couple of blocks from the hospital. My mom was in the other room, and I was at my computer, manically reading anything I could find on both Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease, even though my mom's symptoms didn't fit neatly into either diagnosis. Confused, uninformed, and feeling powerless, it was then that I experienced something that I'd never felt before. My vision narrowed and darkened, and fear enveloped my consciousness. Even with my limited insight at the time, I could tell what was happening. Heart pounding, hungry for air, a feeling of impending doom. I was having a panic attack. Whether it lasted minutes or hours, I can't be sure, but even as the physical manifestation subsided, the emotional dissonance remained. I chewed on that sensation for days afterward. After I returned to LA and the initial storm cleared, I felt like I was left standing on a shattered landscape, surveying the path ahead without a map or compass. My mom began taking the chemical band-aids, but I felt continual unease. Surely the fact that we had no family history of dementia meant that there had to be something environmental triggering her illness. What changed in our diets and lifestyles between my grandmother's generation and my mother's? Was my mom somehow poisoned by the world around her? As these questions circled my head, I found little room to think about anything else, including my career. I felt like Neo from The Matrix, reluctantly conscripted by the White Rabbit to save my mother. But how? There was no Morpheus to guide me. I decided the first step was to pack up my West Coast life and move back to New York to be closer to my mom. So I did just that, and spent the following year reading everything I possibly could on both Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. Even in those early months, as I'd sit on her couch after dinner, face buried in research, I can recall watching my mom pick dishes up off the dining room table. Dirty plates in hand, she'd begin taking a few steps in the direction of her bedroom instead of the kitchen. I'd watch quietly, counting each second that would pass before she'd catch herself, as the knot that had formed in my stomach tied itself tighter. Every time, my fortitude in the search for answers was renewed. 1 year turned into two, and 2 years turned into three, as my fixation on understanding what was happening to my mom consumed me. One day, it dawned on me that I had something that few others have: media credentials. I began to use my calling card as a journalist to reach out to leading scientists and clinicians around the globe, each of whom I've found to hold another clue in my scavenger hunt for truth. To date, I've read hundreds, if not thousands, of discipline-spanning scientific papers, and I've interviewed dozens of leading researchers and many of the most highly respected clinicians in the world. I've also had the opportunity to visit research labs at some of our most respected institutions: Harvard, Brown, and Sweden's Karolinska Institute, to name a few. What external environment allows our bodies and brains to thrive rather than malfunction? That became the basis of my investigation. What I've found has changed the way I think of our most delicate organ and defies the fatalistic view given to me by the vast majority of neurologists and scientific experts in the field. You will be surprised, perhaps even shocked, to learn that if you're one of the millions of people worldwide with a genetic predisposition to developing Alzheimer's disease, statistically you have a 1 in 4 odds of that being the case, you may respond even better to the principles proposed in this book. And by following them, you'll likely have more energy, better sleep, less brain fog, and a happier mood today. Through this journey, I've realized that medicine is a vast field with many silos. When it comes to knowing how best to care for something as complex as the human body, let alone the brain, you have to break apart those silos. Everything is related in unimaginable ways, and connecting the dots requires a certain level of creative thinking. You'll learn about these many relationships in this book. For example, I'll share a method of fat burning so powerful, some researchers have called it biochemical liposuction, and how it may be your brain's best weapon against decay. Or how certain foods and physical exercises actually make your brain cells work more efficiently. While I'm dedicated to communicating the intricacies of nutrition to laypeople, I'm also passionate about speaking directly to doctors because surprisingly few are adequately trained in these topics. I've been invited to teach as well as learn from medical students and neurology trainees at esteemed academic institutions such as Weill Cornell Medicine. And I've had the opportunity to lecture at the New York Academy of Sciences alongside many of the researchers cited in this book. I've helped create tools that are being used to teach physicians and other healthcare providers around the world about the clinical practice of Alzheimer's prevention, and I've co-authored a chapter on the same topic in a textbook geared to neuropsychologists. I've even assisted with research at the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian. What follows is a result of this gargantuan and unending effort to understand not only what happened to my mother, but how to prevent it from happening to myself and others. My hope is that by hearing about how to make your brain work better in the here and now, you'll prevent your own decline and push your cognitive health span to its natural limits. How to use this book. This book is a guide to attaining optimal brain function with the pleasant side effect of minimizing dementia risk, all according to the latest science. Maybe you're looking to hit the reset button on your mental agility to clear the cache, so to speak. Perhaps you're hoping to increase productivity and gain a leg up on your competition. Maybe you're one of the millions of people around the globe battling brain fog, or depression, or an inability to cope with stress. Perhaps you have a loved one suffering from dementia or cognitive decline and are fearful for them, or of succumbing to the same fate. No matter what led you to pick up Genius Foods, you're in the right place. This book is an attempt to uncover the facts and propose new unifying principles to counter our collective modern malaise. You'll learn about the foods that have become casualties of the modern world, raw materials to build your best brain yet, replaced by the biological equivalent of cheap particle board. Every chapter delves into the precise elements of optimal brain function, from your precious cell membranes to your vascular system to the health of your gut. All through the lens of what matters most, your brain. Each chapter is followed by a genius food, containing many of the beneficial elements discussed in the surrounding text. These foods will serve as your weapons against cognitive mediocrity and decay. Eat them, and eat them often. Later in the book, I'll detail the optimal genius lifestyle, culminating in the genius plan. I've written this 3-part book to be listened to from beginning to end. But feel free to treat it as a reference and skip from chapter to chapter. And don't be afraid to take notes. Throughout, you'll also find insights and doctor's notes highlighting my friend and colleague Dr. Paul Graywall's clinical and personal experience with many of the topics we'll cover. Dr. Paul has had his own challenges, having gone through medical school with what is now familiar to many in the Western world, obesity. Desperate to find a solution to his weight challenges, he ventured out to learn everything he could about nutrition and exercise, topics that are unfortunately all but ignored by med school curricula. The truths he discovered resulted in his shedding a dramatic 100 pounds in less than a year, for good, and he'll be sharing these lessons on exercise and nutrition in the chapters that follow. Science is always unfinished business. It's a method of finding things out, not an infallible measure of truth. Throughout this book, we'll use our understanding of the best available evidence while taking into account that not everything could be measured by a science experiment. Sometimes observation and clinical practice are the best evidence we have, and the ultimate determinant of health is how you respond to a given change. We take an evolutionary approach. We hold the position that the less time a food product or medicine or supplement has been around, the higher the burden of proof for it to be included in what we consider a healthful diet and lifestyle. We call this guilty until proven innocent. See the section on polyunsaturated seed oils in Chapter 2 as an example. Personally, I started this journey from a blank slate, following the evidence wherever it took me. I've used my lack of preconceived notions to my advantage, to keep an objective distance from the subject and ensure that I've never missed the forest for the trees. Thus, you will see a linking of disciplines that may not be connected in other books of this genre. For example, metabolism and heart health and brain health and how you actually feel. We believe that bridging these divides holds the keys to the cognitive kingdom. Finally, we know that there are genetic differences between individuals, as well as differences in our health and fitness levels that will determine things like carbohydrate tolerance and response to exercise. We've found the broadly applicable common denominators that will benefit everyone and have included sidebars with guidance on how to customize our recommendations to your own biology. My hope is that when you finish listening to Genius Foods, you'll understand your brain in a new way, as something able to be tuned up like a bicycle. You'll see food anew, as software able to bring your brain back online and run your endlessly capable mind. You'll learn where to find the nutrients that can actually help you remember things better and give you a greater sense of energy. You'll see that actually slowing the aging process, including cognitive aging, is just as much about the foods you omit from your diet as those you choose to consume, as well as when and how you consume them. I'll also share with you the food that may shave more than a decade off of the biological age of your brain. I have to be honest, I'm so excited for you to begin this journey with me. Not only will you begin feeling your best within 2 weeks, you'll be fulfilling my hidden agenda and perhaps my one true goal for you, to make use of the latest and best available evidence so that you might avoid what my mom and I have experienced. We deserve better brains, and the secret lies in our food, the Genius Foods. Part 1. You are what you eat. Chapter 1. The Invisible Problem. Men ought to know that from the brain and from the brain only arise our pleasures, joys, laughter, and jests, as well as our sorrows, pains, griefs, and tears. Through it, in particular, we think, see, hear, and distinguish the ugly from the beautiful, the bad from the good, the pleasant from the unpleasant. It is the same thing which makes us mad or delirious, inspires us with fear, brings sleeplessness and aimless anxieties. In these ways, I hold that the brain is the most powerful organ in the human body. Hippocrates. Ready for the good news? Nestled within your skull, mere inches from your eyes, are 86 billion of the most efficient transistors in the known universe. This neural network is you, running the operating system we know as life. And no computer yet conceived comes close to its awesome capabilities. Forged over millions and millions of years of life on Earth, your brain is capable of storing nearly 8,000 iPhones worth of information. Everything you are, do, love, feel, care for, long for, and aspire to is enabled by an incredibly complex, invisible symphony of neurological processes. Elegant, seamless, and blisteringly fast, when scientists tried to simulate just 1 second of a human brain's abilities, it took supercomputers 40 minutes to do so. Now for the bad news. The modern world is like the Hunger Games, and your brain is an unwitting combatant, hunted mercilessly and relentlessly from all sides. The way we live today is undermining our incredible birthright, fighting our optimal cognitive performance, and putting us at risk for some seriously nasty afflictions. Our industrially ravaged diets supply cheap and plentiful calories with poor nutrient content and toxic additives. Our careers shoehorn us into doing the same tasks over and over again, while our brains thrive with change and stimulation. We are saddled with stress, a lack of connection to nature, unnatural sleep patterns, and overexposure to news and tragedy. And our social networks have become replaced by the social network, all of which lead ultimately to premature aging and decay. We've created a world so far removed from the one in which our brains evolved that they are now struggling to survive. These modern constructs drive us to compound the damage with our day-to-day actions. We convince ourselves that 6 hours in bed means we've gotten a full night's sleep. We consume junk food and energy drinks to stay awake, medicate to fall asleep, and come the weekend go overboard with escapism, all in a feeble attempt to grasp a momentary reprieve from our daily struggle. This causes a short circuit in our inhibitory control system, our brain's inner voice of reason, turning us into lab rats frantically searching for our next dopamine hit. The cycle perpetuates itself, over time, reinforcing habits and driving changes that not only make us feel crappy, but can ultimately lead to cognitive decline. Whether or not we are conscious of it, we're caught in the crossfire between warring factions. Food companies, operating under the invisible hand of the market, are driven by shareholders to deliver ever-increasing profits lest they risk irrelevance. As such, they market foods to us explicitly designed to create insatiable addiction. On the opposing front, our underfunded healthcare system and scientific research apparatus are stuck playing catch-up, doling out advice and policy that, however well-intentioned, is subject to innumerable biases, from innocuous errors of thought to outright corruption via industry-funded studies and scientific careers dependent on private interest funding. It's no wonder that even well-educated people are confused when it comes to nutrition. One day we're told to avoid butter, the next that we may as well drink it. On a Monday we hear that physical activity is the best way to lose weight, only to learn by Friday that its impact on our waistline is marginal compared to diet. We are told over and over again that whole grains are the key to a healthy heart, but is heart disease really caused by a deficiency of morning oatmeal? Blogs and traditional news media alike attempt to cover new science, but their coverage and sensational headlines often seems more intent on driving hits to their websites than informing the public. Our physicians, nutritionists, and even the government all have their say, and yet they are consciously and subconsciously influenced by powers beyond the naked eye. How can you possibly know who and what to trust when so much is at stake? My investigation. In the early months following my mother's diagnosis, I did what any good son would do. I accompanied her to doctor's appointments, journal full of questions in hand, desperate to attain even a sliver of clarity to ease our worrying minds. When we couldn't find answers in one city, we flew to the next. From New York City to Cleveland to Baltimore, though we were fortunate enough to visit some of the highest-ranking neurology departments in the United States, we were met every time with what I've come to call diagnose and adios. After a battery of physical and cognitive tests, we were sent on our way, often with a prescription for some new biochemical band-aid and a little else. After each appointment, I became more and more obsessed with finding a better approach. I lost sleep to countless late-night hours of research, wanting to learn everything I possibly could about the mechanisms underlying the nebulous illness that was robbing my mom of her brain power. Because she was seemingly in her prime when her symptoms first struck, I wasn't able to blame old age. A youthful, fashionable, and charismatic woman in her 50s, my mom was not, and still is not, the picture of a person succumbing to the ravages of aging. We had no prior family history of any kind of neurodegenerative disease, so it seemed her genes could not be solely responsible. There had to be some external trigger, and my hunch was that it had something to do with her diet. Following that hunch led me to spend the better part of the past decade exploring the role that food and lifestyle factors like exercise, sleep, and stress play in brain function. I discovered that a few vanguard clinicians have focused on the connection between brain health and metabolism, how the body creates energy from essential ingredients like food and oxygen. Even though my mom had never been diabetic, I dove into the research on type 2 diabetes and hormones like insulin and leptin, the little-known signal that controls the body's metabolic master switch. I became interested in the latest research on diet and cardiovascular health, which I hoped would speak to the maintenance of the network of tiny blood vessels that supply oxygen and other nutrients to the brain. I learned how the ancient bacteria that populate our intestines serve as silent guardians to our brains, and how our modern diets are literally starving them to death. As I uncovered more and more about how food plays into our risk for diseases like Alzheimer's, I couldn't help but integrate each new finding into my own life. Almost immediately, I noticed that my energy levels began to increase, and they felt more consistent throughout the day. My thoughts seemed to flow more effortlessly, and I found myself in a better mood more often. I also noticed that I was more easily able to direct my focus and attention and tune out distractions. And though it wasn't my initial goal, I even managed to lose stubborn fat and get in the best shape of my life, a welcome bonus. Even though my research was initially motivated by my mom, I became hooked on my new brain-healthy diet. I had inadvertently stumbled upon a hidden insight that the same foods that'll help shield our brains against dementia and aging will also make them work better in the here and now. By investing in our future selves, we can improve our lives today. Reclaim your cognitive birthright. For as long as modern medicine had existed, doctors believed that the anatomy of the brain was fixed at maturity. The potential to change, whether for a person born with a learning disability, a victim of brain injury, a dementia sufferer, or simply someone looking to improve how their brain worked, was considered an impossibility. Your cognitive life, according to science, would play out like this. Your brain, the organ responsible for consciousness, would undergo a fierce period of growth and organization up to age 25, the peak state of your mental hardware, only to begin a long, gradual decline until the end of life. This was, of course, assuming that you didn't do anything to accelerate that process along the way. Hello, college. Then, in the mid-90s, a discovery was made that forever changed the way scientists and doctors viewed the brain. It was found that new brain cells could be generated throughout the life of the adult human. This was certainly welcome news to a species heir to the flagship product of Darwinian evolution, the human brain. Up until that point, the creation of new brain cells, called neurogenesis, was thought to occur only during development. In one fell swoop, the days of neurological nihilism, a term coined by neuroscientist Norman Doidge, were over. The concept of lifelong neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain to change up until death, was born, and with it a unique opportunity to mine this landmark discovery for greater health and performance. Flash forward just a couple of decades to today, and you could almost develop whiplash from the progress being made toward the understanding of our brains, both how we can protect them and how we can enhance them. Take the developments in the field of Alzheimer's disease research. Alzheimer's is a devastating neurodegenerative condition affecting more than 5 million people in the United States, with numbers expected to triple in the coming years. It is only recently that diet was thought to have any impact on the disease at all. In fact, though the disease was first described in 1906 by German physician Alois Alzheimer, 90% of what we know about the condition has been discovered in just the last 15 years. Give dementia the finger. I had the privilege of visiting Mia Kivipelto, a neurobiologist at Stockholm's Karolinska Institute and one of the foremost researchers exploring the effects of diet and lifestyle on the brain. She leads the groundbreaking FINGER trial, or Finnish Geriatric Intervention Study to Prevent Cognitive Impairment and Disability, the world's first ongoing, large-scale, long-term randomized control trial to measure the impact that our dietary and lifestyle choices have on our cognitive health. The trial involves over 1,200 at-risk older adults, half of whom are enrolled in nutritional counseling and exercise programs, as well as social support to reduce psychosocial risk factors for cognitive decline, such as loneliness, depression, and stress. The other half, the control group, receives standard care. After the first 2 years, initial findings were published revealing striking results. The overall cognitive function of those in the intervention group increased by 25% compared to controls, and their executive function improved by 83%. Executive function is critically important to many aspects of a healthy life, playing a key role in planning, decision-making, and even social interaction. If your executive function isn't working up to snuff, you might complain that you're unable to think clearly or get stuff done. And the volunteer's processing speed improved by a staggering 150%. Processing speed is the rate at which one takes in and reacts to new information, and it typically declines with age. The success of this trial highlights the power that a full lifestyle makeover can have on improving the way your brain works, even in old age, and provides the best evidence to date that cognitive decline does not have to be an inevitable part of aging. As a result in this shift in our understanding of the brain, institutions like the Center for Nutrition, Learning, and Memory at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign have sprung up, dedicated to filling in the gaps of our collective neuro-knowledge. Other emerging specialties have followed suit, eager to explore the links between our environments, including diet, and various aspects of our brain function. Take Deakin University's Food and Mood Center, which exists solely to study the link between diet and mood disorders. In 2017, the center revealed how even major depression might be treated with food. I'll detail these findings and the exact foods that can boost your mood in the chapters to come. Still, many remain in the dark about this vast and rapidly growing body of research. A study performed by AARP found that while over 90% of Americans believe brain health to be very important, few know how to maintain or improve it. Even our own well-meaning physicians, to whom we turn when we're scared and confused, are seemingly behind the times. The Journal of the American Medical Association itself reported that it takes 17 years on average for scientific discoveries to be put into day-to-day clinical practice. And so, we move through the motions as the old narrative continues. But it doesn't have to be this way. A genetic master controller. You. Without imperfection, neither you nor I would exist. Stephen Hawking. Mistakes is the word you're too embarrassed to use. You ought not to be. You're a product of a trillion of them. Evolution forged the entirety of sentient life on this planet using only one tool. The mistake. Robert Ford, played by Anthony Hopkins, Westworld, HBO. Our genes were once considered our biological playbook, the code that ran our lives, including how our brains functioned. Understanding this code was the goal of the Human Genome Project, completed in 2002, with the hope that by the end, the secrets to curing human disease, including cancer and genetic diseases, would be splayed out in front of us. Though the project was a remarkable scientific achievement, the results were disenchanting. It turns out that what distinguishes one person from the next is actually quite insignificant from a genetic standpoint, accounting for less than 1% of total genetic variation. So then why do some people live well into their 90s and beyond, maintaining robust brains and bodies, while others do not? Questions like this have continued to perplex scientists in the wake of the project and have given rise to the idea that there has to be some other factor or factors to account for the wide range of differences in health and aging displayed by the global human population. Enter epigenetics, the phoenix to rise from the project's ashes. If our genes are akin to the keys on a grand piano with 23,000 notes, we now understand that our choices are able to influence the song that is played. This is because while our choices can't change our hard-coded genetics, they can impact the layer of chemicals that sit atop our DNA telling it what to do. This layer is called the epigenome, derived from the Greek word epi, which means above. Our epigenome affects not only our chances of developing whatever diseases we're most at risk for, but also the moment-to-moment expression of our genes, which respond dynamically to the countless inputs we give them. Perhaps even more shrouded in mystery is the sheet music, the order and sequence and frequency of activation of every gene in the development of a given organism, but that's for another book. While a treatise on epigenetics could span volumes, this book will zero in on one of the marquee maestros to play on our genetic keyboard, diet. Will your genetic conductor be a Leonard Bernstein or a fifth grade student pounding the ivories for the first time? It may depend largely on your dietary choices. What you eat will determine whether you'll be able to modulate inflammation, train a prize-winning immune system, and produce powerful brain-boosting compounds all with the help of a few underappreciated nutrients and lifestyle techniques that have become seemingly lost to the modern world. As you proceed, remember, nobody's a perfect specimen. I'm certainly not, and neither is Dr. Paul, though he'd argue otherwise. When it comes to genes, everyone has traits that, when thrust up against the modern world, increase their risk for cardiovascular disease, cancer, and yes, dementia. In the past, these differences may have driven the evolution of our species, serving as advantages in our mysterious ancestral world. Now, these differences are why any person that makes it to age 40 has an 80% chance of dying from one of these maladies. But there's good news. If there's anything that the past few years have shown us, it's that genes are not destiny. They merely predict what the standard American diet will do to you. This book will position you to be in the 20% as we address how to keep your brain and vascular system healthy and even check some boxes for cancer prevention and weight loss while we're at it. In the next few chapters, I'll describe an evidence-based antidote to the brain-shrinking standard American diet and lifestyle, replete with nutrients to fuel your ravenous brain and physical and mental techniques to take back the robustness that is your evolutionary destiny. Your primary opponents in the battle for your cognitive birthright are inflammation, overfeeding, nutrient deficiencies, toxic exposure, chronic stress, physical stagnation, and sleep loss. If this sounds like a lot, don't worry. They overlap, and tending to one often makes it easier to improve on the others. Here's a brief overview of each of these bad guys. Inflammation. In a perfect world, inflammation is simply the ability of our immune systems to spot clean cuts, wounds, and bruises, and to prevent the occasional bacterial tourist from becoming a full-blown infection. Today, our immune systems have become chronically activated in response to our diets and our lifestyles. This has been recognized in the past several years as playing a pivotal role in driving or initiating many of the chronic, degenerative diseases plaguing modern society. Widespread inflammation can eventually damage your DNA, promote insulin resistance, the underlying mechanism that drives type 2 diabetes, and cause weight gain. This may be why systemic inflammation correlates significantly with a larger waistline. In the coming chapters, we will definitively link these same factors to brain disease, brain fog, and depression as well. Overfeeding. We haven't always been able to summon our food with a few swipes on a smartphone. By solving our species' food scarcity problem during the agricultural revolution, we've created a new one. Overfeeding. For the first time in history, there are more overweight than underweight humans walking the earth. With our bodies constantly in a fed state, an ancient balance has been lost, one that has set us up for low brain energy, accelerated aging, and decay. Part of this has to do with the fact that many foods today are specifically designed to push our brains to an artificial bliss point beyond which self-control becomes futile. We'll explore this in Chapter 3. Nutrient deficiency. In Vanilla Sky, one of my favorite films, writer-director Cameron Crowe wrote, "Every passing minute is a chance to turn it all around." This is particularly true of our body's ability to repair against the damages incurred due to aging, but only when we feed them the right ingredients. With 90% of Americans now falling short in obtaining adequate amounts of at least one vitamin or mineral, we've set the stage for accelerated aging and decline. Toxic exposure. Our food supply has become awash in food-like products. These products directly contribute to the three factors mentioned above. They're stripped of nutrients during the production process, they promote their own overconsumption, and they drive inflammation. Most insidious, however, may be the bonus toxic additives, the syrups, industrial oils, and emulsifiers that directly and indirectly contribute to an activated immune system, driving anxiety, depression, suboptimal cognitive performance, and long-term risk for disease. Chronic stress. Chronic psychological stress is a major problem in the Western world. Like inflammation, the body's stress response was designed by evolution to keep us safe, but it has been hijacked by the modern world. While chronic stress is directly toxic to our brain function, covered in Chapter 9, it also sends us reaching for unhealthy foods, thus compounding the damage done. Physical stagnation. Our bodies are designed to move, and ignoring that fact causes our brains to suffer. The evidence on exercise is mounting to an impressive degree, validating it not only as a method of boosting our long-term brain health, enabling us to fend off diseases once thought unpreventable, but as a means of enhancing the way we think and learn. Similarly, we've evolved with another type of exercise, thermal exercise. We are great at changing our environment to suit our comfort levels, but the relative lack of variation in temperature we experience on a daily basis may undermine our peak brain power and resistance to disease. Sleep loss. Last but not least, good quality sleep is a precondition for optimal brain function and health. It gives you the ability to make dietary and lifestyle changes by making sure your hormones are working for you, not against you. And it purifies your brain and backs up your memories. Costco-sized gains for dollar store effort. And yet, our collective sleep debt is rising. As I've mentioned, any one of these villains has the power to wreak cognitive destruction, and they have formed an unholy alliance to do so. But if you allow this book to be your bow and arrow, sword and spear, you may just stand a chance. In the coming chapters, we'll lay out a roadmap to circumvent the shortcomings of our discordant, high-stress lifestyles as we marry evolutionary principles with the latest clinical research. We'll use diet to reset your brain to its factory settings, leaving you feeling and performing your very best. And we'll even venture into the new and exciting science surrounding the microbiome, the collective of bacteria that live within us, working the knobs and levers of our health, mood and performance in astounding ways. They provide a new lens from which to assess our every choice. Up next, as you begin to reclaim your cognitive legacy, you're going to learn about the nutrient that your brain is desperate for. May the odds be ever in your favor. Genius food number one, extra virgin olive oil. Place some extra virgin olive oil, or EVOO, in a spoon, and then slowly slurp it up like you're eating soup and being particularly rude about it. Yes, I'm telling you to drink oil, but you'll see why in a second. You should in short order notice a spicy feeling in the back of your throat. That's a compound called oleocanthal. Oleocanthal is a type of phenol, plant compounds that powerfully stimulate our body's own repair mechanisms when we consume them. Phenols are usually found linked together in the form of polyphenols. Oleocanthal possesses anti-inflammatory effects so powerful that it is comparable to taking a small dose of ibuprofen, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, but without any of the potential side effects. Inflammation, as you'll learn, can strongly negate neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain to change throughout life, and even produce feelings of depression, as research is now beginning to show. Extra virgin olive oil is a staple food in the Mediterranean diet, and people who consume these kinds of diets display lower incidence of Alzheimer's disease. Oleocanthal may play a role here as well, having demonstrated the potential to help the brain clear itself of the amyloid plaque, the sticky protein that aggregates to toxic levels in Alzheimer's disease. It does this by increasing the activity of enzymes that degrade the plaque. It has been shown in large, long-term trials to protect the brain against decline and even improve cognitive function when consumed at volumes of up to a liter per week. And if protecting your brain wasn't enough, EVOO has been shown to block an enzyme in fatty tissue called fatty acid synthase, which creates fat out of excess dietary carbohydrates. Aside from oleocanthal, EVOO is also a rich source of monounsaturated fat, which is a healthy fat that helps maintain the health of your blood vessels and your liver, and can even help you lose weight. One tablespoon also contains 10% of the recommended intake of vitamin E per day. Vitamin E is an antioxidant that protects fatty structures in your body, such as your brain, from the wear and tear of aging. Nicholas Coleman, one of the world's few oleologists, specializing in the cultivation of ultra-premium extra virgin olive oils, had a few tips to share with me about finding the right olive oil. For one, color has no bearing on the quality of the oil. The single best way to assess an oil is to taste it. Good extra virgin olive oils should taste grassy, never greasy. Because oleocanthal is responsible for virgin oil's peppery taste, it can in fact be used as a measure of how much oleocanthal is present in the oil. Stronger oils can be so spicy that you may find yourself coughing from the heat, which is actually a classification of oil quality. Next time you find yourself consuming 3-cough oil, you'll know you found a keeper and your brain will thank you for it. How to use. Extra virgin olive oil should be the main oil in your diet, to be used liberally on salads, eggs, and as a sauce. Ensure that the oil is kept in a bottle that shields it from light. Dark glass or tin is fine, and store in a cool, dry place. Chapter 2. Fantastic Fats and Ominous Oils. My recollections from childhood in the late 80s and 90s have a few standout milestones. Singing the lyrics to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles theme song on repeat, Turtle Power! My first Ghostbusters Halloween outfit, and waking up at an ungodly hour on Saturday mornings to watch one of the first great serials of the modern television renaissance, X-Men the Animated Series. My memory of my family's dietary pattern is a little less vivid. Meals in my house were often prepared by my mom, who was as health conscious as any busy woman with 3 little boys, and a 4th if you count my dad, could be. She watched the nightly news, read the New York Times and various magazines, and was generally hip to the mainstream health advice of the time. There was no social media, but TV and magazines did a pretty good job of relaying the latest discoveries and government recommendations. And this is how many, including my mom, got their ideas about nutrition. The main cooking oils in my home were canola oil and corn oil, because they were cholesterol-free and had no saturated fat. Many nights, dinner consisted of some kind of wheat-based noodle or spaghetti, tossed in margarine, the purported health alternative to artery-clogging butter. It was a dish that would win the heart of any dietitian of the early 90s. Unfortunately, the totality of my mother's, and in all likelihood your family's, concept of diet at the time was the end result of misguided nutrition science, biased government policy, and business doing what it does best, cost-cutting, lobbying, and marketing. And it was all total bullshit. It began in the 50s when Americans were hungry for a solution to an increasingly urgent public health problem, heart disease. My mom, born in 1952, grew up in the midst of what must have seemed like a terrible national epidemic. Heart disease was believed to be an inevitable accompaniment of aging, and something that physicians could do little about. In The Big Fat Surprise, food journalist Nina Teicholz recounts the furor. A sudden tightening of the chest would strike men in their prime on the golf course or at the office, and doctors didn't know why. The disease had appeared seemingly out of nowhere and had grown quickly to become the nation's leading cause of death. That is until one outspoken scientist emerged from the dark halls of academia with a candle. His name was Ansel Keys, a pathologist at the University of Minnesota. Even though Keys was not a medical doctor, he had attained a bit of nutritional street cred during World War II when he created the K-ration, a system of boxed meals delivered to soldiers on the battlefield. After the war, Keyes was enlisted by the Minnesota Health Department to contemplate the country's sudden cardiovascular quandary. Keyes' hypothesis was that dietary fat was at the center of the epidemic, and to illustrate this, he drew up a graph from national data that depicted a perfect correlation between total calories consumed from fat and death rates from heart disease. 6 countries were included. Ansel Keys is often credited for having set off the domino effect that sculpted nutrition policy for the next 60 years, but his argument was built on data that was biased and ultimately misconstrued. His graph highlighted a correlation between 2 variables that had been cherry-picked amid the endless sea of variables that one encounters when studying things like diet across the population scale. But correlations cannot prove causation. They can only show relationships that are used to guide further study. In this case, however, the causal presumption was made, turning Keys into a national hero and landing him on the cover of Time magazine in 1961. As it was taking a foothold in the national conversation, there was a growing chorus of voices within the scientific community who saw through Keys' work. Many thought that the validity of Key's correlation itself was questionable. He omitted data that was available from 16 other countries that, if included, would have shown no such correlation. For example, there was no epidemic of heart disease in France, a country whose citizens love their cheese and butter, the so-called French paradox. Others doubted that there was any link between fat consumption and heart disease at all. John Yudkin, founding professor of the Department of Nutrition at Queen Elizabeth College in London, was one of Key's vocal dissenters. As early as 1964, Yudkin thought sugar was the culprit, not fat. He wrote, "In the wealthier countries, there's evidence that sugar and sugar-containing foods contribute to several diseases, including obesity, dental caries, type 2 diabetes mellitus, and myocardial infarction, or heart attack." Reanalysis of Key's data many years later confirmed that sugar intake had always correlated more strongly with heart disease risk than any other nutrient. After all, refined sugar up until the 1850s had been a rare treat for most people, a luxury often given as a gift, but we'd been consuming butter for millennia. Another researcher, Pete Ahrens, expressed similar befuddlement. His own research suggested that it was the carbohydrates found in cereals, grains, flour, and sugar that might be contributing directly to obesity and heart disease. Research decades later would link these very factors to brain disease as well. But Yudkin, Ahrens, and their colleagues failed in their attempts to speak above the charismatic and combative Keys, who also happened to have a powerful secret ally. In 1967, a review of the dietary causes of heart disease was published in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine, or NEJM. It was a no-holds-barred takedown, singling out dietary fat and cholesterol as the chief cause of heart disease. The role of sugar was minimized in the widely read paper, taking the wind out of the sails of any who would try to debate Keys. But reviews of this kind and scientific research in general are meant to be objective, not swayed by the influence of money. While researchers often rely on outside funding, in such cases the sources of their funding must be disclosed to alert their peers of any potential bias. Unfortunately, this was not the case with that NEJM article. The scientists behind it were each paid the equivalent of $50,000 in today's money by a trade organization called the Sugar Research Foundation, now known as the Sugar Association, a fact that was not disclosed in the original paper. Worse yet, the foundation even influenced the selection of studies reviewed by the scientists. "They were able to derail the discussion about sugar for decades," said Stanton Glantz, a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, in an interview with the New York Times. Dr. Glantz published these findings in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2016. If you'd like to think such nefarious tactics are behind us, think again. The sugar industry continues to muddy the scientific waters, funding research that seems to conveniently conclude that the claims against sugar are overhyped. Enter Frankenfood. To what degree can food be manipulated before we can no longer call it food? For many years, products that didn't adhere to the strict definitions of basic foods had to be labeled as imitation. But a label bearing the I word spelled marketing doom for products, so the food industry lobbied to have this imposition deregulated. In 1973, they got what they wanted. In Defense of Food, journalist Michael Pollan writes, "The regulatory door was thrown open to all manner of faked low-fat products. Fats in things like sour cream and yogurt could now be replaced with hydrogenated oils or guar gum or carrageenan. Bacon bits could be replaced with soy protein, the cream in whipped cream, and coffee creamer could be replaced with cornstarch, and the yolks of liquefied eggs could be replaced with, well, whatever the food scientists could dream up, because the sky was now the limit. As long as the new fake foods were engineered to be nutritionally equivalent to the real article, they could no longer be considered fake." Suddenly, the Frankenfood floodgates were open, and the food supply was awash in fake products. It was like the breaking of the portal to hell in the 1987 movie The Gate, but instead of an onslaught of ghoulish creatures, they were the processed doppelgangers of real foods, now accompanied by a low-fat or fat-free halo. One of the more absurd products of the flock came out in the late 90s, potato chips that had been formulated with the molecule olestra. It was a dream come true, a lab-created fat substitute that miraculously slid through your digestive tract unabsorbed. The only downside? The cramps, bloating, and anal leakage that created the equivalent of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in unsuspecting underpants everywhere. How do you avoid Frankenfood when even today a trip to the modern supermarket is the equivalent of skipping across a field of landmines? Shop around the perimeter of your supermarket, which is usually where the perishable fresh food can be found. It's the aisles where Frankenfood usually lies in wait. And stick to the Genius Foods, as well as the extended shopping list in the Genius Plan in Chapter 11. You can find a comprehensive guide to surviving the modern supermarket at http://maxl.ug/supermarkets. Eventually, Keyes published the Seven-Country Study, a landmark research achievement, albeit with similar flaws to his earlier work. In it, Keyes shifted the focus from total fat consumption to saturated fat. Saturated fat is solid at room temperature and is found in foods like beef, pork, and dairy. As anyone who's ever poured grease down a drain knows, this type of fat can clog pipes, and to an America at the dawn of nutrition science, it made perfect sense that this would happen in the body as well. Spoiler alert, it doesn't. Newly focused on these artery-clogging fats, Keyes was able to influence a little-known organization at the time called the American Heart Association. With an investment from a massive manufacturing conglomerate called Procter & Gamble that produced, among other things, polyunsaturated vegetable oils, which are highly processed and, unlike saturated fats, liquid at room temperature, the organization finally had the ability to become a national powerhouse. It bought up TV and magazine ads alerting Americans to the boogeyman hiding in their butter. When the U.S. government adopted the idea in 1977, the low-fat myth became gospel. In an instant, Americans became the target of manufacturers seizing the opportunity to churn out healthy low-fat, high-sugar foods and polyunsaturated fat-based spreads, exclaiming that they were cholesterol-free. Chemical and heat-extracted oils like canola and corn oil were promoted to health food status, while naturally occurring fats from whole foods, even avocados, were shunned. Overnight, margarine, a rich source of a synthetic fat called trans fat, became heart-healthy, buttery spread. Between industry shortcuts, scientific hubris, and governmental ineptitude, we took real, natural foods and warped them into a chemical minefield of nutrients. The first victim of this fatty fiasco? Our brains, which are made almost entirely of fat. 60% of the delicate, damage-prone human brain is composed of fatty acids. And, as you'll hear coming up, the kinds of fats you consume dictate both the moment-to-moment quality of your brain's function and its predilection to disease. Fats take a marquee role in every aspect of your life, from your decision-making processes to your ability to lose weight, to your risk for diseases like cancer, and even the rate at which you age. By the end of this chapter, you'll be able to choose the fat-containing foods that optimize not only your cognitive performance, executive function, mood, and long-term brain health, but your overall health as well. If you take anything away from this section, let it be that it's not the amount of fat you consume, it's the type. Polyunsaturated fats, the double-edged sword. Polyunsaturated fats are a type of dietary fat that's ubiquitous in our brains and bodies. The most well-known polyunsaturated fats are the omega-3 and omega-6 fats, which are considered essential because our bodies need them and we can't produce them on our own. We therefore have to get these fats from food. Two of the most important omega-3 fats are eicosapentaenoic acid, or EPA, and docosahexaenoic acid, or DHA. These are the good fats found in fish such as wild salmon, mackerel and sardines, in krill, and in certain algae. They're also found in smaller amounts in grass-fed beef and pasture-raised eggs. While EPA is a whole-body anti-inflammatory agent, DHA is the most important and abundant structural component of healthy brain cells. Another form of omega-3 found in plants is called alpha-linolenic acid, or ALA. ALA needs to be converted to EPA and DHA to be utilized by your cells, but the body's ability to do this is highly limited and varies in efficacy from person to person. I'll come back to this. On the other side of the polyunsaturated coin, we have the omega-6 fatty acids. These are also essential to a healthy brain, but the American diet now includes far too many of them in the form of linoleic acid. These omega-6 fats went from appearing in our diet as oils delivered in trace quantities by whole foods to becoming major caloric contributors to the American diet in just a few short decades. They are the predominant type of fatty acid found in the grain and seed oils that we now consume in excess. Safflower, sunflower, canola, corn, and soybean oils. Night of the Lipid Dead. As coveted as polyunsaturated